now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're here with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
Indeed. And joining us today are The Times' very own Tom Roddy and chief football writer Henry Winter. Coming up, we're going to take a look at Chelsea's class of 19. We'll ask why Eddie Nketiah isn't getting a game at Leeds. And we'll look ahead to Manchester United's huge clash with Premier League leaders Liverpool. First, though, we are looking back at what was a sad night for football in Bulgaria. Henry was in Sofia, as well as Tom, on a night where the show on the pitch was ruined by events off it. The England debutant Tyrone Mings says he could hear the racist abuse as clear as day, but everybody made the decision to continue the Euro 2020 qualifier against Bulgaria in Sofia on Monday night. Play was halted twice in the first half because of abuse from supporters in line with UEFA protocol. England had the option to walk off the pitch but played the full 90 minutes before winning the game 6-0. Now, Henry, we spoke about this last week and you encouraged the players to walk off at the very first instance of any abuse, which would have ignored UEFA's 3-point protocol. Surely now UEFA have to look at what is a ridiculous protocol and realise that it's farcical.
Well, it is farcical. I mean, what other industry would you have it where you can be sitting, say, at your desk in an office and someone racially abuses you and they're given another chance to racially abuse you before actually proper action is taken? I mean, it should be one strike and you're out. I mean, you mentioned Tyrone Mings. Mings was talking afterwards that he had the racist abuse during the warm-up. Mm. So, and the officials were told then, the officials should have taken them off. I mean, but personally, I just think you look at the players, you talk to the players, you look at UEFA, and we've been in the situation for decades now with UEFA and their inability to react properly to racism. And it almost has to be taken out of the hands of the authorities. You can't trust the authorities to take action. And it really has to come down to the players. Three-step protocol didn't work. There was still racist abuse in the second half. The players, in fairness, said they didn't really hear it in the second half. Southgate certainly said that to us, but still they should have walked. Otherwise, you know, when England go on the qualifying road again for 2022, there will be other incidents like this, and eventually they will say enough is enough and walk.
I mentioned that you were quite vocal about the fact that they should have walked off at the first instance. That was before the game. We talked about it. Are you in any way disappointed, if that is the right word to use, that they didn't?
I'd never be disappointed with the England players, and particularly this group, who are a really fantastic collection of players and also of people as well. We saw that during the World Cup, the way they spoke out on a range of issues. Danny Rose on racism and mental health, Raheem Sterling's Instagrams on racism, and calling out the media, calling out us a lot, saying we're not particularly diverse when he looks at the press box and press conferences. I think they're a very admirable, you know, there's a lot of integrity to the squad. So no, I absolutely wouldn't question them. I'm not down there. It was a decision, you know, that they took. Gregor would understand the mentality more than I would. But I just think that my long, very sad experience of UEFA and my long, very sad experience of going to places like this, you know what's going to happen. You know there's going to be racist abuse. You know the authorities are just going to come down, probably in this case with a £100,000 fine and a ground closure. Maybe the pressure that's being put on them by the media and the players, they might sort of go a little bit further. But really, unfortunately, it's now down to the players. And again, if I come back to it, if you're sitting in an office and you get racially abused twice before your employer actually does anything, you might actually say, I'm going to take action the first time.
Tom, I mentioned you were there as well, alongside Henry. Can you just tell us exactly what it was like that night?
I mean, to me, it felt a bit like a pantomime with the three-step protocol in terms of in the stadium, during the second step, which is meant to see the players go off the field and didn't, which turned out to be England's decision, and fair play to them. It was because it was 4 minutes away from half time. But the way the home fans booed the break, it just felt like an absolute pantomime. And you had, I could see a woman to my right who had a thumbs down towards it. There was jeering, and I think there was the monkey chanting in amongst that as well. It was a horrific atmosphere. And of course, we had the story emerged yesterday, Martin Ziegler's story, that you had stewards who were removing their bibs and joining in. And it was just, it wasn't an atmosphere I'd ever experienced before. You also had down below us to our left a group of riot police dressed up in riot gear, masks and helmets on, prepared to come in, and you could tell that it was affecting the players badly. And Jordan Henderson got into a dispute with the Bulgarian manager, and there was kind of the animated dispute between the two of them. And I think it was a horrible situation.
Gareth Southgate, along with every member of England's travelling party, has been praised, Gregor, for the way he dealt with and considered his players. Just how much of a role model do you think he is then, the England manager?
Yeah, I think he handled it brilliantly. I think, you know, I said on the podcast beforehand, I've kind of questioned him bringing the topic up in the last international break. You know, it was a huge run up to this. They built the issue far greater than the game. But I think it was necessary, really, and I think it was taking a stand. And I don't think Henry said he shouldn't. You know, we should not criticise them in any way, shape, or form. There was no right or wrong answer to how to handle this. I'm slightly uncomfortable with people discounting the desire of the players to want to continue playing. You know, and a lot of people have kind of done that. I think, you know, these are all enlightened young guys. They knew the situation. They were prepared. They were briefed about what might happen. And they still chose to continue playing. I don't think, you know, I think that's important. They're the guys out there. And also, you know, some players, Raheem Sterling said even beforehand that he didn't want to walk off. He wanted to. He feels better going out and smashing them. And that's what they did. So I think Gareth Southgate and England have handled it absolutely brilliantly. And I think, you know, I'm not entirely convinced what walking off does. I know it's a big statement. It'd be an even bigger statement than what was made, but I'm not entirely convinced. The real punishments need to be dished out to Bulgaria. If they're seen to be weak, complicit, apologetic even, which they were verging on, for overt racism, throw them out of the competition, ban them from international football. I think that's a far, far more important step to take than whether the players walk off the pitch or not.
Southgate actually looked quite tired with it all afterwards. I think the focus ahead of the game and the lead up to it had really kind of taken its toll on him. But I think what he was saying is that they had managed to highlight what happened by informing the officials of what had gone on, but also finish the game, which the players wanted to do. Tyrone Mings said after the game, "We wanted to finish it and thump them. That was, you know, get the result." But on Southgate being a role model, I think the thing with that is he never, even away from the racism, he never gets excited, Southgate, in terms of if it's victory or defeat. He's always quite measured. And I think what I found quite refreshing is that we've got a kind of an easygoing coach who has the perspective of the wider world on everything, because throughout all of this he always said at home our house isn't in order, because he referenced the Ineffion problems at Hartlepool and Dover. He referenced the, you know, you've got the Raheem Sterling at Chelsea and you've got a banana thrown on the pitch at the Emirates. He made the point throughout the whole thing, when it would have been easy to get swept along with it, that we have our own problems.
Yeah, he was very different to the Bulgarian manager, that is for sure. Mm. Henry, let me ask you, Gregor mentioned there that Bulgaria perhaps should be thrown out of a UEFA competition. Clearly the protocol doesn't work. The punishments as a result of racist abuse by UEFA given out previously are not a deterrent in any way. Where do you stand on what should happen next?
well, I love this idea of them being thrown out of Euro 2020 when their players' incompetence seems to be doing that somewhat effectively on its own. I think it's for tournaments to come, and I think that should definitely happen. I mean, what has been good is that the Bulgarian politicians, and we all know the issues with the sort of BFU and their incompetence and the problems that they've had, but the Bulgarian government has obviously realised this is an absolute PR disaster for a country I've found on the whole pretty hospitable. I mean, you know, you do go around there and you see Nazi stickers, you do see offensive, you know, respect racism slogans or daubed on walls. I mean, I was quite cautious in the build-up to it about how much of this, because I mean, I go for a run on the morning of the game, the morning before the game, and go and to see where the fans are, go and look around the stadium for anyone's there. And the, you know, there was Nazi stickers there. There was sort of anti-UEFA, anti-racism initiatives paraphernalia there. And you just think, well, you know, don't print too much of this. But my phone is full of pretty offensive images. So what do you do? I mean, it's long term, it's education. As Tom rightly says, we've got issues in this country as well. I think the difference is slightly, certainly the media seems to be addressing it in this country. And there was a pretty strong denial that there was any problem in the match from the Bulgarian, or many of the Bulgarian journalists at the game. And when Southgate came in and, as Tom said, talked in a very measured fashion, one of the Bulgarian cameramen went FU Southgate as he walked out. So, look, Bulgarians have got to look at themselves. I think the government acted rightly, addressing the issues in the Bulgarian Football Union. I mean, look, there's so many reasons for this, but it all comes back to one thing, is that the players, ultimately, I think, are going to set the tone on this. And I think the direction of travel, which is, having been, you know, I'm fortunate I've covered about 20 of these incidents with England, you know, from Madrid to all over Eastern Europe, the direction of travel with the players' thoughts is increasingly, we have had enough. And clearly the next step is that they will walk off. It's been interesting talking to Southgate on this as well, because in Podgorica, we were talking to him after the game when England players, Raheem Sterling, Danny Rose and Callum Hudson-Odoi, were racially abused by Montenegrin fans. And we said to him immediately afterwards in the sort of separate briefing that the newspapers have with him, why didn't you walk off? And he hadn't really crossed his mind. And he got into a bit of an emotional tangle about it. So maybe I should have taken more action, whatever. So you can see the direction of travel that the players are going through and that the manager, Southgate, is going through. And England will walk off the field in the next sort of 2-3 years. And the image that will send around the world will just be so strong. More than anything UEFA can do, more than anything we in the media can say, more than anything sort of governments can do. And it will be an iconic image. It will be on the front of Time magazine. It will just go everywhere. And it will just say, the players are saying enough is enough. You cannot have sport in an in-sporting, inhospitable climate. So, look, we can all see the direction of travel. I'm completely with Gregor. Certainly the players, you know, they're the ones in the middle of it. They're certainly not going to get any blame. But from long experience, they will walk at some point.
Henry, thank you.
My pleasure.
Train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
England's under-21s were also in action during the week. A 5-1 win it was at Stadium MK against Austria, which saw Callum Hudson-Odoi score two. So you were there, Tom. How highly does the Chelsea youngster rate, do you think, in England's future?
Potentially very high. I think it's a... He's a very talented player, but I think the issue there is that it's a very congested position. In that you've got Jadon Sancho, Raheem Sterling, Marcus Rashford, all young guys who he's going to be competing with for with England in future. And I think there's still a lot of development still there for Callum Hudson-Odoi. Jadon Sancho seems to be a more complete player at this age. And I think eventually, even though Rashford came in Bulgaria and was putting in an impressive performance, I think that will... in the long term become Sancho's position. With Hudson-Odoi, I thought he's developing well under Lampard, and I think he'll do well to working with Lampard, because we had the Grimsby game in the League Cup, and Lampard said after the game that he wasn't too sort of pleased with Callum at half time, that he said to him about his runs, directing his runs more diagonal, and you saw an impact immediately after, and also at the Southampton game. So I think working with Lampard will aid him greatly. But I think he does have a very bright future with England. Yeah,
I'm just like delighted to see him back to full fitness as well.
Yeah.
I wrote a piece a few weeks ago, just when he sort of returned to training, so outlining I experienced the same injury, ruptured Achilles, as him, and I was my sort of spring and strength in that leg was never the same. Obviously he was at Chelsea and I was not. But it's a tough, it's a nasty injury. And especially for a player who's so explosive and powerful and, you know, fleet footed. And he's only 18, and it was really could have been really a cruel way to sort of, his career has not really even started yet. But all the signs are from his sort of cameos and play so far since he's returned is that he's sort of back to full fitness and full strength and full of promise.
Well, that injury obviously has seen him just limited to two appearances for Chelsea in the Premier League this season. Just to touch on Chelsea with Callum Hudson-Odoi, so young, as you've pointed out, Gregor, at 18, and really just flourishing and starting to begin his career, but more positives for Chelsea that they haven't yet another youngster they can turn to.
Yeah, who knew this academy was there? Yeah, he's. I think you've kind of seen he's come straight in, and the story weirdly with Callum Hudson-Odoi goes into Christian Pulisic a little bit at Chelsea, in that the £58 million signing, or however much it was, is now being kept out of the side, and even though Pulisic is still a young player himself, Callum Hudson-Odoi's potential and how much the fans already love him. I mean, they have a song for him already, and at 18 years old, that's not too bad.
He's done something right.
Exactly. And I think he's already assisting. I think he's got three assists already in his last three games for Chelsea. I think he links up well with Mason Mount and Tammy Abraham, which again isn't a surprise given their sort of history playing together. And I think he'll be in the long run this season, I think he'll be a starter and will be playing ahead of Pulisic, certainly.
You mentioned Mason Mount. When you also look at some of the other youngsters within that Chelsea squad, Fakaia Tomori, Reece James, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, Tammy Abraham as well, to go alongside Hudson-Odoi, there have been, Gregor, some comparisons with Manchester United's class of 92. You're already smirking, so I'm not sure if you're laughing at what I'm going to say, but
go on.
Can we compare the two? Can we actually think that this could be a golden generation coming through?
It's certainly a generation with lots of potential.
Look at you tempering your...
Look, the thing is, you know, the class of 92 only became a thing because they went and won the league, and they did so on a regular basis, and Manchester United became a kind of dynasty over that period, you know. So if we look at the landscape now, it's going to be hard for them to win the league in the short term, but there's a lot of, you know, a lot of promise, and these guys are so young. It's their first full season really in Premier League football, and they're already really impressing. So, you know, developing together, if they can stick together and Lampard is the manager. That's probably the key thing. He's the man at the helm who shows trust in them. It will be very interesting when the transfer ban is up and you see how much money they start throwing around and whether they keep the sort of focus on youth that was slightly thrust upon them. But under Lampard, I think the signs are that he will stick with that, and certainly with the talent at his disposal, why wouldn't you?
Well, Callum Hudson-Odoi shone in Adie Boothroyd's under-21 side in midweek, but one young lion perhaps shone even brighter. The on-loan lead star, Eddie Nketiah, scored a hat-trick against Austria. The Arsenal loanee admitted, though, that he is frustrated by his role as a lead substitute after the match. He has yet to actually start a championship game for Marcelo Bielsa's side this season. That's despite scoring 4 goals in 9 matches across all competitions. Tom, before we talk a bit more about why he maybe not be playing for Leeds, or certainly not starting, what kind of a talent is he?
Yeah, I think he's shown himself as a poacher, I think. More than that, there's much more to him than that. But that is, at his age, I think being a poacher is a big compliment, because this sort of movement around the box. Austria's defence on Tuesday night wasn't the best, but he showed his prolific ability, really, and I think he links up well with the team, and it's smart the way he moves around the box. I think we actually spoke to him after the game. He came out and spoke to us, and he seemed himself visibly kind of dumbfounded as to why he's not playing for Leeds. And for Adie Boothroyd, I mean, I think he's scored 8 goals in 7 games for the under-21. So he's shown his ability. He's shown his potential. We knew it before he went to Leeds at Arsenal. We knew he was a name that for a few years has been in the Arsenal Academy coming through. And Adie Boothroyd spoke about, I spoke to him last week, and he was talking about microwaving players and getting them ready. What he was saying about it was progressing them too quickly was his point.
Okay.
Just to explain that on Adie's behalf, out of context. But I think Nketiah is one who is developing quickly as well, in and amongst a very talented under-21 side.
I don't think I've ever heard a comparison with a microwave before. But so we mentioned there, he's not starting for Leeds. He's coming on and playing his part, and as I've mentioned, scored 4 goals already. Why is he not starting, do you think? Someone who, as Tom has just alluded to, is quite prolific in front of goal.
Well, we know all about Marcelo Bielsa's sort of overall kind of the holistic vision of his team, and, you know, you've got to be pressing from the front, and there's been some question marks about whether he's fully suited to that role. You're basically playing up front on your own in a Leeds team. Although I wouldn't necessarily say Patrick Bamford is the sort of immediately jumps to mind as someone who does that either, although he has benefited from time with Bielsa. But that kind of all brings it down to the choice of club he made in the summer, I think. You know, there was some reports about the lengths to which the clubs were kind of going to try and get secure his signature for this season. I think Bristol City and Dusseldorf, mm-hmm, and Leeds all sort of made a presentation, PowerPoints and all, in a London hotel. And they chose Leeds.
Wow.
It's really detailed stuff now. And I did a piece about loan managers last week as well, and the sort of microscopic detail that they go to in sort of monitoring their players just now. And Nketiah even said, I think, in the quotes after that game the other day, that he feels like an Arsenal player on loan at Leeds still. He still feels very much like an Arsenal player. But they want to see him play, you know. Mm. This is an important stage in his development. And knowing all of that, knowing who Bielsa is and the way his team plays, perhaps it was a bit of an error in judgment. I think, you know, Bristol City are a team who have got a good track record of taking players, particularly from Chelsea. Tammy Abraham's one who flourished. They really, you know, they trust them, and they play good football as well. So perhaps they will come to rue that. I don't know. Maybe he will change. He'll go back in January. Maybe I don't know if there's a clause. But I think if he doesn't start playing soon, then certainly they will be looking to to bring him back or to send him along to another club.
I think Gregor's spot on with the whole it being an important stage of his development, because, and it is with Arsenal as a whole, you know, they have a really talented set of young players with Joe Willock, Reece Nelson, Emil Smith Rowe, and they're all emerging kind of at the same time, and Eddie Nketiah is one of them. And I think this could potentially damage sort of his development. And I think if it doesn't change, Arsenal will certainly bring him back. He's Eddie Nketiah said the other day that he's in constant contact with Aubameyang, who comes across from what you hear as a real good figure and role model within that Arsenal side. And I think the way he spoke, as Gregor touched on, that he feels like an Arsenal player, I got the feeling he wanted to almost go home, possibly. You know, if he couldn't get into that side.
Mm. I found it interesting that Arsenal were one of the last clubs to actually appoint a loan manager. When I was doing research for that piece, only in January they appointed a guy called Ben Napper, who was their first team analyst. And Manchester City were doing this since 2012.
And for those that aren't quite aware of what a loan manager does, what do they do exactly?
Well, they take an active role in finding the correct club for their players, and when they're at the club, they do as much as they can to, as Eddie Nketiah is saying, to make them still feel a part of the club, to debrief all of their games, to speak to them on a regular basis and check how they're, if they're moving to another country, to, you know, smooth that transition. It's an important role. It's a really kind of growing role, and because this is seen as such a vital step in players' development, if they can't get in the first team in the Premier League team, then they go away and they try and get games, and if they're a success, then there's a greater chance of them coming. Tammy Abraham, again, is the best example. He's a huge success in the Championship, gone away, scored 50-odd goals in the Championship over two seasons. And without that, would he be the same player he is now?
Good question. Did you ever have a PowerPoint presentation when you were going on loan or moving to a new club?
I didn't ever go on loan.
Now, David De Gea and Paul Pogba have been ruled out of Manchester United's Premier League clash with Liverpool. De Gea underwent scans on Tuesday after suffering an injury in Spain's Euro 2020 qualifying match with Sweden, and so will not be fit for the weekend. As for Pogba, well, he's already missed four of United's last seven and will still be a huge blow. But the De Gea news has come at a time when Ole Gunnar Solskjaer really didn't need it, Gregor.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, one could imagine that he'd be quite busy on Sunday.
Yeah.
With Manchester United playing. Yeah, absolutely. De Gea has been kind of, although he's had his moments, but he has been one sort of beacon of reasonable consistency throughout Manchester United's malaise. And really, yeah, they could do with a fully fit team at the moment, because it's kind of, I think with every passing week without them registering a win or having a sort of half decent performance, the pressure is growing and growing on Solskjaer, and really on the whole club. It's the lowest point you can really remember of in years at that football club. So yeah, I think it's going to be a tough afternoon on Sunday for Manchester United.
You can count on two hands, Tom, how many matches De Gea has missed through injury or illness for United. In nearly 8.5 years, he's only been unavailable for 6 games. Sergio Romero, who is, of course, De Gea's deputy for the last 4 years, has only started 7 times in the Premier League, but has kept 6 clean sheets and lost just the once. So there's no cause for concern, is there?
I think in the goalkeeping situation, I think Romero is a more than able understudy.
Yeah.
It's actually more the symbolism of losing someone like De Gea. It's just another blow for Solskjaer and the team. I mean, talking about Romero, he hasn't actually played in 17 months, so that's a little bit of an issue, kind of the freshness. And, mm-hmm. and De Gea in the Spain game against Sweden, he'd actually made, I think, 2 unbelievable, typical De Gea saves before he came off on the hour. But you've got Romero's played 96 times for Argentina. When he's come in before, we know he's a brilliant understudy. But I think it's more going to be the symbolism in the dressing room, knowing before the game that they haven't got De Gea in a team that is kind of devoid of leaders and has been for some time.
In the opposite goal, Alisson could be set for a return, Gregor. The Brazilian goalkeeper, of course, has been out of action since being forced off in the 4-1 win over Norwich at Anfield on the opening day of the season. Adrian, who was the summer signing for Liverpool, has performed very well in Alisson's absence, with Liverpool unbeaten. So where do we stand on what Jurgen Klopp might do? Do you keep with Adrian, who, as we say, has done really well, or do you bring back someone of Alisson's stature?
He'd be well within his rights to keep the faith with Adrian, because, as you say, he has done well. There was one little blip at Southampton, if I remember correctly, with his, you know, he's not quite the same goalkeeper with the ball at his feet as Alisson. Mm-hmm. But Alisson is one of those players, as you say, of a stature and a standing in the team, and he made such a difference to Liverpool last year. He's just one of those players you imagine as soon as he's ready to go back in, he will do. Similar to someone like Van Dijk or a Salah up front, you know, just players who can make such a difference on their own. And again, sort of tying in with what Tom said there, just sort of carry a presence and an air of calm about them as well, that is really sort of separates them and, you know, marks them out as one of the best there is in their position. So I would imagine if he's fit and ready, and as I hear, and he's been training for a couple of weeks and working very hard, if he's fit, then they'll play him.
I think the deciding factor there will be what Gregor said, that it's the ability with his feet will be the deciding factor for Jurgen Klopp. The fact that Alisson is better than Adrian, and that is the style of football that Jurgen Klopp wants to play. I think he'll play for that reason.
Well, Liverpool have actually, incredibly, won just the once at Old Trafford this decade, and that was when David Moyes was in charge of Manchester United. It was a 3-0 win back in 2014. They even failed to win against an injury-ravaged United at Old Trafford last season with that 0-0 draw. So is it possible that the Old Trafford factor plays into the minds of Liverpool? We know this is a heated rivalry, Gregor.
Yeah, it's one of the Premier League's iconic fixtures, you know, if not the. But I still think the answer is no, I'm afraid. It's kind of Liverpool are so superior at the moment to Manchester United, a weakened Manchester United at that, and a club that really has sort of come to terms with its demise and is not comfortable with it in the slightest. So the pressure's on Manchester United, absolutely. Liverpool go there expected to win, but I don't think that really puts more pressure on Liverpool. I think they're on such a good run of form. A win for Liverpool would equal Manchester City's record of 18 consecutive Premier League wins, which would be a remarkable achievement and is motivation in itself. So yeah, I think the pressure is all on Manchester United.
Well, we know how depressing a start it's been for Manchester United, who sit 12th in the Premier League right now, Tom. Could a bad outcome in Sunday's derby spell the end of Ole at the wheel?
It has been, hasn't it? The worst start in 30 years at Man United. I don't think it would spell the end. I don't think it would. I think defeat is almost expected, which isn't, you know, we've been hearing ever since Fergie left at Man United that Man United are always expected to win, but I think a defeat is completely expected this weekend. I think what's important is that for Solskjaer will be the run of games that come after that, because they've got in the league, they've got Norwich, Bournemouth, Brighton. So those are the winnable games. I think it's going into through October, into November. I think that's when, if it goes badly then, that's when he's going to be in trouble.
Okay, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Tom Roddy and Henry Winter.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. Have a good weekend, and we'll be back on Monday.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.